This episode could be triggering for sensitive listeners and contains mature content. It may not be suitable to all listeners. Should you need any emotional assistance, please see the show notes for telephone numbers that you can call. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are my own and do not reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by contributors, such as the host, guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors, are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. A well-respected lawyer loses his right to practice. This man, who thrives on power and loves to argue, now has a lot of time on his hands. Time and anger. But where or to whom will he direct this anger? This is Decoding Cults, and I'm your host, Palsy. This episode is about the Westboro Baptist Church, Part 2. Last week, we kicked off with the history of Fred Phelps, the beginnings of the Westboro Baptist Church, and some of the doctrine that was taught there. If you have not listened to part one, I suggest you pause here and go back. That way, this episode will make more sense. This week, we'll delve further into the doctrine and also continue with the history of the church. Westboro's congregation was not immune from the snitching culture which some leaders of high control groups like to implement. If you found out that anyone within the group was thinking of leaving or had defied any of its rules, you were responsible to turn them in. And if you were found to be defiant or questioning in any way, the rest of the congregation would not be allowed to speak to you until you had redeemed yourself. You would also be labeled as satanic, divisive, and that you don't know what you're talking about. You would get more chores given to you as a punishment. If any matters of discipline came up, everyone had to participate, vote, and agree on the correctional action to be taken. There had to be 100% consensus to the action. If one person disagreed, then no action would be taken. This meeting usually consists of the perceived wrongdoer sitting in the church sanctuary with all of the members of the church while they are interrogated around their wrongdoing. If you leave or are excommunicated, then you're completely cut off from everyone and they no longer speak to you at all. Those who are made to leave or have escaped are labeled either as an Esau, as I explained in the previous episode, the brothers Jacob and Esau were used as a cautionary tale where Esau was basically condemned by God from the womb. People who leave are also said to be a slave to their lust and are vilified within the community. If someone was even secretly thinking of leaving, they'd be afraid to do it because they thought if they do, they die. Fred had taught his congregants that if anyone left, they would die from like a car crash or cancer. He had created the us versus them mentality by convincing his followers that they were the elect and the rest of the world, who were reprobate and destined for hell. This ensured that the followers were so scared to be excommunicated as they were convinced that they would be going to hell if they were. Fred would put himself forward as Saint Peter's proxy. Just as a side note, those who are unfamiliar with Saint Peter, he was one of Jesus' apostles and was promised the keys of the kingdom, so he is seen as the gatekeeper of heaven. He is said to be the one who opens the gate for all of those who will be going into heaven. Now, if you were voted out of the church, you would be told that you have been delivered to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. Despite his claims of anti-racism, Fred taught his followers the Calvinist view of the story of Ham in the Bible. They believed that the curse that Ham had gotten for ridiculing his father Noah's nakedness was that his children were born black. Thus, in their minds, showing that African-American people were a cursed race, were meant to be servants, and were lesser than. Quite the contradiction from his public persona, if you remember from the previous episode. Girls and women had to dress modestly, but they didn't have to be covered from head to toe. They were only allowed a small number of nude or light pink colors to paint their nails with. They weren't allowed to pierce their ears, and if it was found that one of the girls wasn't dressed appropriately or to the church's standard, an email would be sent out to the entire congregation. This email would include terms like, so-and-so is a slut or a whore. Holy moly. After this communication blast, each member of the congregation would then need to go to that girl and tell her how bad she is to her face. And if she did not stop, she would go to hell and get kicked out of the church. Complimenting one another was also not allowed, especially if one of the members happened to be beautiful. Apparently, this was because saying someone was pretty was basically just empty vanity. Women and girls needed to cover their heads with scarves during Sunday service. They were not allowed to have short hair, as Fred believed that a woman's uncut hair was a sign of her obedience and subjugation to God and to her father and her husband. Getting a husband, however, was tricky. Because no one was allowed to marry anyone outside of the church, and as 80% of the church was made up of family members, it was very slim pickings, and most of the women stayed alone and celibate. Some of the younger women would even be told that they were not allowed to get married. You couldn't even date, as being alone with someone from the opposite sex, who was not family, would apparently lead to fornication, or, at the very least, the appearance of evil, which was to be avoided at all costs. They were taught that lust was the beginning of every sin, and death and hell were the end of every sin. You can't just decide that you love someone and they pop the question. No! You need to ensure that there is a formal agreement between the parents of the people who want to get married. And only if this union was chosen and approved by Fred. Even when engaged, you couldn't spend any time alone with your fiancé, just in case it looked bad. So you had to have a chaperone at all times when you were together. You're not even allowed to kiss until you have spoken your vows to one another. Sounds very similar to KSB. The funny thing about this rule is that there were two of the family members who did have children outside of wedlock, which is taught by Fred as being this huge sin, but those same women would then be even more strict and enforce this non-fornication rule on the next generation. And, as you can imagine, from the way that Fred had written off his father, divorce was strictly forbidden to any of the followers in the church. Oh, and birth control? Not an option, neither was abortion. Fred would say that the womb's business is God's business and that they had no right to mess with it. The Phelps children were expected to produce many children and provide for them. This is why there are so many Phelps children and grandchildren. Shirley, Fred's fifth child, had 11 children of her own. Children, no matter what their age, had to stay home with their parents and their elders until they married. They also have to obey every order given to them and have to ask permission to go anywhere or do anything outside of the house and church. They have no privacy. Oh, and Spare the Rod makes another appearance here. The children would be punished not to the extent which Fred did to his own children, but they would get lashings with paddles and the like if they misbehaved in any way. Leaving bruises after these punishments wasn't an issue, because in the eyes of the followers it was justified by Proverbs 20 verse 30, where it says, "The blueness of a wound cleanseth away evil." Oh, brother. Men and boys had to wear their hair short. They were never allowed to have friends over to their house, and were not allowed to visit other people's houses. In my opinion, not allowing the children to go to the homes of others was an attempt to ensure that they don't get influenced by outside families and get to see a new or better way of life. In addition to using Bible verses as justification for any rule or action, Fred also liked to use thought-stopping cliches, somewhere along the lines of, "You can't trust your heart because your feelings will lead you astray," or "The best ability is dependability." Besides the usual fire and brimstone sermons, Fred's doctrine included homophobic teachings in which, according to his son Nate, there was a special place in hell reserved for the gay people. This teaching will become very important late in the series. He was also anti-Semitic, believing that old tale that the Jews were responsible for Jesus' death, and he also disliked them because he believed that the Jews were Christ rejecters. Anyone who wasn't part of the Westboro Baptist Church was bad. They didn't celebrate Christmas because they believed that it was a pagan holiday, as it's not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. If there were any Christmas activities held at the schools or in the classrooms where Fred's children or grandchildren attended, he demanded that they don't participate. They were not allowed to go out and partake in Halloween festivities, as this was seen as idolatry. They were not allowed Easter eggs or chocolate bunnies during Easter, and didn't celebrate Thanksgiving. The children weren't even allowed to be in the room in school where the festivities were being held. Instead, they would need to go to another room or sit in the library. Sounds quite similar to the Jehovah's Witnesses that also can't participate in some of the festivities. Fred's grandchildren would also attend public school, and the group would refer to them as walking picket signs. This will become relevant later in the story. The children were, however, taught to be very friendly and polite to everyone at school. The children mostly hung out with each other because they, A, didn't really trust outsiders because they were taught that outsiders were evil, and B, there weren't many other children who would want to hang out with them too much because of all their protests and their weird beliefs. Now let's get back to the history of Fred. Shortly after he took over the church, in an effort to save money, the family moved into the church building. As the mortgage was still held by the Eastside congregation, they convinced the county assessor that it should be taxed as a private residence. Fred successfully contested the decision. Fred then sued for libel, but lost the case. According to the Oxford Dictionary, libel is a published false statement that is damaging to a person's reputation or a written defamation. In 1966, Fred filed for the Democratic nomination to the Kansas House, 45th District, but didn't get chosen. This loss was very disappointing to him. Then, in 1969, Fred was suspended from practicing law for 2 years when it was found that he was guilty of professional misconduct. However, this did not curb Fred's behavior. In the previous episode, I mentioned that the children were made to go out and sell boxes of sweets to help bring in money for the family. Well, it turns out that Fred never paid his suppliers for the sweets. So much for thou shalt not steal. Anyway, by 1972, the sweet company sued Fred for the non-payment. One of the companies was successful in their lawsuit, but Fred never ended up paying them back. That same year, The principal of the school where Nate and Jonathan attended became worried about the boys and reported Fred to the authorities. The boys were assigned court-appointed lawyers. This, however, didn't stop Fred from beating them. Of course it wouldn't. The boys would lie to the authorities as they were more afraid of their father than anyone else. The charges were eventually dropped. That's so sad. I mean, these boys really had an out. Anyway. Fred in turn sued the school, and when the principal put together a statement of events which led them to report Fred, he quickly dropped the lawsuit. He also ran for district attorney of the Shawnee County, but he didn't qualify as he hadn't had enough time served as a lawyer. On 8 November 1977, a formal complaint was filed against Fred. He had reportedly completely lost his cool with a court reporter named Caroline Brady. He had accused her of purposefully being late in providing him with a court transcript. Fred had initially sued her for $2,000 for damages and $20,000 for punitive damages. I looked it up. According to odblaw.com, punitive damages are also called exemplary damages, which are damages assessed in the legal process to punish a defendant for negligence. While Fred was viciously questioning Caroline on the stand, he accused her of many terrible things, including being a slut. Fred lost the case and decided to appeal. He had apparently gotten affidavits from 8 witnesses that would have convinced the court to vote in his favor. But Caroline had contacted those same people, and they all said that Fred had never actually contacted them. A formal complaint was written up on Fred with the reason that he had clearly misrepresented the truth to the court. Then, on 20 July 1979, Fred was permanently disbarred from practicing law in the state of Kansas, but he was still allowed to practice in federal court. I wasn't 100% sure on how these two court systems work in the US, so I found on judiciallearningcenter.org that state courts are courts of general jurisdiction. They hear all the cases not specifically selected for federal courts. Just as the federal courts interpret federal laws, state courts interpret its own laws. This helps the states retain power and make sure that the national government doesn't become too strong. Despite this, Fred kept on harassing court staff. In 1985, 9 federal judges in Kansas lodged a disciplinary complaint against Fred. 5 of his children, Fred Jr., Jonathan, Margie, Shirley, Elizabeth, and one of his daughters-in-law, Betty. The complaint alleged that they had all made false accusations against the judges. This complaint would drag out over several years and was finally settled in 1989, when the Phelpses realized the extent of the evidence that was collected against them. As part of the settlement, Fred agreed to stop practicing law in federal court as well, thus ending his career in any court system. Fred Jr. was suspended for 6 months, and Margie was suspended for a year. Not being able to litigate must have left a huge empty space in Fred's life, but that was soon to be filled by a new crusade. Before we get into that, let's quickly look at the history of gay rights in America. The first gay rights group was founded in the 1950s. Then, in the 1960s, Illinois became the first state to do away with the anti-sodomy laws, which basically decriminalized homosexuality in the state. According to History.com, the Stonewall Riots, also called the Stonewall Uprising, began in the early hours of June 28, 1969, when New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay club located in Greenwich Village in New York City. The raid sparked riots among the bar patrons and neighborhood residents, as police roughly hauled employees and patrons out of the bar, leading to 6 days of protests and violent clashes with law enforcement outside of the bar on Christopher Street, in neighboring streets, and in nearby Christopher Park. The Stonewall riots served as a catalyst for the gay rights movement in the United States and around the world. 1 year later, on 28 June 1970, the first Pride marches were held in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And these marches were the beginnings of the Pride celebrations that we now know across the globe today. People of the LGBTQIA+ community have fought over many decades just to have the same rights as everyone else. Then, in the 80s and the 90s, there was an outbreak of AIDS, and this was further fuel to the fire to fight for gay rights. Back then, it was still looked down upon to be gay, and many people had to resort to going to places that were not always the safest to be able to meet up with people from their own community. One of these places happened to be Gage Park, which is situated in Topeka. And it is in this very park where Fred would not only find the start of his next crusade, but would also be the place where his little congregation would eventually become famous. Or should I rather say infamous. In the summer of 1989, Fred was cycling through Gage Park with one of his grandsons. Fred had a habit of riding ahead a bit and then circling back round to his grandchild. On one of these occasions, while he was circling back, he allegedly saw two men who he thought were soliciting his four-year-old grandson to go into some bushes with them. Now, there is no mention if there was an altercation between Fred and these men or, and this is just my opinion, the two men were just walking past and Fred read way too much into it. Regardless, this perceived solicitation had Fred spring into action and he found his new purpose. Clean up Gage Park from those evil homosexuals. First, he spoke to the park official, who told him that there had been many male couples who would enter and exit the park together, and that he would pass on any citizen complaints to his superiors. He then investigated police raids and news stories that were centered around this subject at the park. Armed with as much information as he could gather, he wrote to the mayor. The mayor responded that they were aware of the issue and were in the process of creating a program to address it. Over the next 2 years, Fred would write to various city officials and regularly attend city council meetings to find out what they are doing about the issue that he had raised. Then he reached out to all of the other churches in the area to ask them to stand with him. They didn't. As a matter of fact, they would counter-protest the Westboro group. In 1990, Fred ran for the governor of Kansas. My opinion on this is that he ran so that he could do something about this so-called problem. While running, he would attack all of his opponents very personally. Needless to say, with only 6.7% of the votes, he lost the election. When none of his tactics worked out, Fred started a new campaign, the Great Gage Park Decency Drive, where he designed picket signs, enlisted his children, grandchildren, and other members of the church to go and picket at the park. They kicked off their campaign in June of 1991. Back then, if you were picketing, you needed to walk in a circle. The group picketed the park so much that they had eventually made a circular path in the grass. Now I'm going to give a trigger warning here, as there will be homophobic slurs from this point forward. These are not my words, and I have nothing but love and respect for the LGBTQIA+ community. The picketers would hold up signs stating slurs like, "Watch your children, gays in the restrooms," or "Watch for gays in the bushes." From the pulpit, Fred would tell his congregation that the gay community was responsible for the AIDS epidemic, that they deserved the death penalty. While the followers would sing parodies of songs during their protest like Get Back in the Closet Again, Back Where Sin is a Sin, Where the Filthy Faggots Dwell While They're on Their Way to Hell, Get Back in the Closet Again, to the tune of Back to the Saddle Again. He'd also publish in newsletters that AIDS was a curse from God brought down on these sinful men. The protests not only brought counter-protests, but also gained attention of the local media. Many questions were raised about not only the protests, but the fact that there were young children holding these signs and singing these songs. They could not possibly understand what they were saying. As opposition to the protests grew, instead of dampening Fred's spirits, it actually bolstered him. I think, and this is just my opinion, that Fred possibly loved all of the attention he was getting, even if it was extremely negative attention. He would tell his followers that the fact that the people were opposing them meant that God was on the group's side. They were the good guys, cautioning the evil rest of the world. As in most cults, using people's negative reaction as a sign that your perceived quest is going well, it helps keep the followers in the church. It's basically like confirmation bias. Each time before the group would set out to go and protest one or another perceived sin, they would all come together and be told exactly what they were to say should they be interviewed. They were told this was to ensure that they were of one mind. In 1992, Fred ran for a seat in the US Senate. He lost, but he did manage to get 30% of the vote. The picketing of Westboro Baptist Church congregation not only continued at the park, but they started expanding to anything which Fred found offensive. They also exchanged the word gay for the very derogatory term fag. Fred announced that they were changing the word because gay essentially means happy, and that these people were not happy, but were headed for hell. He would say that the original meaning of the word faggot is kindling. I looked it up, and according to the Oxford Dictionary, it means a bundle of sticks bound together as fuel. Fred said that the fags fueled the fires of God's wrath, and that they burn in the lust towards one another. It didn't matter how offensive they were to others. They justified it to themselves by stating that they were doing God's work. And offend they did. People would drive past the protesters screaming at them, throwing water and even bottles of urine at them. People would even vandalize the church. Now, I am by no means approving or even supporting what the congregation was saying in any way, shape or form. But throwing urine at them and vandalizing their property, that doesn't seem right to me. The group started requesting that the government make homosexuality a capital offense. In 1993, Fred ran for mayor of Topeka and lost again. Having lost another possible seat of power once again, Fred turned his anger outside the confines of his town. He and a few of his congregants traveled to Washington, D.C. to protest at the Pride event. That same year, they decided they would picket at the funeral of an AIDS victim. To me, this is horrific. Here you have a family mourning the loss of one of their loved ones, and right outside are a bunch of people chanting and shouting horrible slurs at you. Sadly, the funeral picketing would only get worse, but that'll come late in the story. Thankfully, Kansas passed a law regarding the unlawful public demonstration at a funeral under the Crimes Involving Violations of Personal Rights, Article 61. The article basically states that you cannot be within 150 feet or 45 meters from any entrance to a cemetery, church, mortuary, etc., within 1 hour before, during, and 2 hours after the completion of a funeral. You can't obstruct people's movement or impede vehicles during the procession. Should you fail to comply, it will be seen as a Class B misdemeanor, and each day on which a violation occurs shall constitute a separate offense. I found on criminaldefenselawyer.com that a Class B misdemeanor carries a maximum sentence of 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. That's almost 20,000 rand. This law, however, did not deter Westboro Baptist congregation from protesting. As 90% of the Phelps family had a background in law, they obeyed this new article to the letter. They would basically ensure that they were the correct amount of distance away from the funeral while still spewing their hate. It was also in 1993 where Fred appeared on an episode of the Ricky Lake talk show where he stated that homosexuals deserve to die. Later years, Ricky tweeted that he had told her that she worshipped her own rectum, which led her to have Fred removed from the set. I'm not surprised. During the early and mid-1990s, the family would often be arrested for various charges, which for the most part didn't stick. In 1995, a few college students made a pipe bomb which they used to blow up a shed near one of the houses at the church. Thankfully, no one got hurt. Fred offered a $5,000 reward to anyone who could let them know who had committed this crime. When the person was caught, they only spent 16 days in jail, which is also not right. The group launched their anti-homosexual website in 1997. The site would later be renamed to GodHatesFags.com, and they'd later open another one called GodHatesAmerica.com. Sadly, these websites are still active today, and you can't unsee them once you've seen them. With the launch of these websites, the group would receive many threats over the internet and on email. Just a trigger warning here, I'll be covering some grievous bodily harm to people, so if this is in any way triggering to you, please skip ahead around 10 seconds or so. On 7 June 1998, 49-year-old James Byrd Jr. was brutally murdered. His crime? Well, according to his white supremacist killers, being African American. He was dragged behind a car for 5 kilometers. About halfway through, he hit the edge of a culvert which severed his right arm and his head. Then, on 6 October 1998, a 21-year-old student called Matthew Wayne Shepherd was beaten, tortured, and left to die tied to a fence near Laramie in Wyoming. When he was found, he was taken to a hospital where he sadly passed away 6 days later because of the severe injuries that were inflicted on him during the attack. This case made the news because Matthew happened to be gay, and it was widely reported as a hate crime. These two incidents caused such an outrage that on 28 October 2009, the Matthew Shepherd and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act was signed into law. This act included crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. Additionally, it gave federal authorities greater abilities to engage in hate crime investigations that local authorities could not pursue. But back in 1998, Fred got wind of Matthew's murder, and, to no one's surprise, he decided to take the family there to go and pick it. The thing is, Matthew's case was all over the media, and his funeral was obviously going to be covered by the media. So it stands to reason that Fred's little group holding up signs saying things like, "No fags in heaven," would get some notice. And notice they did. This brought the little congregation a lot of attention from across the world. The group started hating on their own country and would raise the flag but have it upside down. Now, in the US, when a person displays an upside down flag, it usually means that the person is in distress or danger. The Westboro followers, however, state that they are flying the flag upside down because they say that America as a nation is in distress because of grievous and bodily sin, because of divorce, abortion, and you guessed it, homosexuality. They then started targeting politicians, actors, and singers who Fred didn't like. Whenever someone of some sort of fame or import would die, the group would say that they had split hell wide open. I've tried to figure out what they mean by this, but I can't fathom why. If you have any ideas, please let me know in the comments or on email. Remember when I mentioned that the children from the church attended public school and were seen by their parents as walking picket signs? Well, those in school and even those at college were tasked to picket outside of their respective institutions during their lunch breaks and carry signs like, "God hates you." They were told that they are representative of the church and should be prepared to be hated by their fellow students. In our next episode, we will continue into the church's history and end off on where they are now. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the subscribe button and rate and review us. It will go a long way into improving the podcast and helping others find it. Please invite your family and friends to listen too. If you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe and like the video. You can also leave comments if you want. You can find me on Facebook and you can email us at decodingcults@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. I have added my PayPal link should you wish to support the show financially. It will go towards purchasing better equipment. If there are any topics around the workings of cults which you would like further explanation on, or if there is a cult that you would like to hear about, email me or post it in the Facebook group. Remember to go and check out By Design Crafts SA and Endeavor AV and tell them that I sent you. The amazing logo art was created by the tattoo artist Jock Jacobs. Thank you so much for listening.